Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Michael Taylor, curator of a Philadelphia Museum of Art exhibition devoted to the works of Marc Chagall and his early 20th century contemporaries in Paris. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns profiles the world-renowned mezzo-soprano Susan Graham. And Susan Lewis looks at the way Phoenixville is reinventing itself through arts, culture and entertainment. The former mill town is getting set to stage its 12th annual Blobfest, an event that kicks off with a reenactment of a scene from the 1958 horror movie that made the Colonial Theatre famous, The Blob. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Marc Chagall was one of the most successful artists of the 20th century. Born in 1887, he grew up in a Russian Jewish ghetto during a time of rank anti-Semitism. In his late teens, he moved to St. Petersburg, where he studied art and was introduced to the worlds of experimental theatre and the Ballet Russe. In 1910, he emigrated to Paris, where he joined a host of other artists, many also Eastern European exiles. Living in La Ruche, an artist's community nicknamed the Beehive because of its honeycomb-like maze of studios, Chagall developed a distinctive style combining cubism with traditions from his Russian homeland. Now, an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art makes the case that Chagall's artistry is more complex than previously realized, and that his work in Paris during those years was greatly informed by his homeland and his experiences in the City of Light. Michael Taylor is the curator of the Philadelphia Museum of Art exhibition Paris Through the Window, Marc Chagall and His Circle.
I felt that Chagall was actually ripe for reinterpretation. I feel like he's an artist who at the end of his life told a great story, which is that he came out of nowhere, almost fully formed as an artist and self-taught, and went on to this glittering career. And what this show, I think, demonstrates for the first time is that he came from somewhere, and that somewhere was Vitebsk in Russia. He trained in Russia with people like Nicholas Roerich and Leon Bakst. And then he ends up in Paris and trains again with people like Metzinger and Delaunay. So he was not fully formed. He actually did have an extensive training, and it had a great impact on his work. Doesn't mean he's not a unique artist. He surely is. But I think this show makes him a more interesting, a more complex artist than we maybe thought of before.
He never loses that Russianness, though.
No, and in fact, we really wanted to bring that out. We added a Ballet Russe section because his early training is in the theatre, and we wanted to bring that out. That's why he loves colour and movement. There is a sort of lovely lightness of his work. He's also a great storyteller, and I think that's part of his upbringing. And when you start to sort of think in these ways, you really realize what he brought to the game, because he does it better than anyone. I think he surpasses his teachers and becomes iconic, really, as one of the great colorists of the 20th century, rivaling Matisse, but also one of the great storytellers. And for that, I think he has no equal.
Speaking of storytelling, your curatorial style is, the aesthetic is obviously important, but so too is the narrative. What's the story you're trying to tell here?
Well, it's true what you say, because I believe that all great exhibitions do tell a story, and the story has to be compelling. And so this story works on many levels. It's about immigration, what can happen to someone who arrives in a city like Paris in May 1911 and reinvents themselves as a modern artist. It's also about exile, because, of course, this man lived through the First World War and the Second World War and was displaced. And it's also a story about struggle. You know, the artist of La Ruche, we sort of did a recreation of that community. And La Ruche means beehive, and it was a studio complex in Paris where it was affordable, and these artists lived one on top of the other. Many of them came out famous, and many of them we've never heard of again.
Most of them Eastern European and very poor when they arrived.
Yeah.
This was the promised land, after all, at the start of the 20th century.
It really was. And the Eastern European artists tended to be the poorest, and they had no visible means of support. So La Ruche was a kind of communal center in the southern fringes of Montparnasse, so very far out from the center of Paris. But what it gave them was a shared identity, and you did have these larger-than-life figures like Jules Pascin and Modigliani would be the most famous. But Chagall is right in the middle of that. And as I said to you before, he came from somewhere. He didn't really live the life that he claimed he did. When he spoke about LaRouche, he said, I locked my door, I never went out. Of course we know that's not true. He was designing the theatre there. He was very much involved with the lives of the other artists, which included such towering figures as Fernand Léger, Alexander Arkhipenko, all of these sort of great artists who come out of LaRouche and in the 20s do become the School of Paris. And Chagall's really at the forefront of that international movement.
And not just visual art. There's a tie-in and indeed a section in the exhibition that talks about the Ballet Russe. So there was, although they would never have described it thus in that time, a multimedia aspect to this.
Definitely. I mean, the way they would have described it was a kind of cross-fertilization of the arts. You had, for the first time, I think, you had the sense in which you weren't just a painter. You could also be a poet and a stage designer. So the sort of compartmentalizations that what used to be in the Renaissance, the sort of professional guilds, was breaking down. And Chagall is one of those figures who just moves across media very easily. He's a great printmaker. He really wanted to reach a big audience. But first and foremost, I think what he brings to this is this kind of poetic sensibility. And all of his works have that sort of wondrous otherworldliness, this sort of the dreamlike quality that we associate with him.
And there's never a sense in any of his work that he's trying to protect his reputation. Various times he goes back to watercolor, he goes, as you say, into printmaking. He's still experimenting and still not worrying about what people will think.
No, I mean, he's utterly prolific, and he rivals Picasso in that sense. He did believe he was a creative genius in everything he did. You know, he signed even the scrappiest piece of paper. But I think what you're talking about is also part of his identity as an artist, because he really reuses a lot of material as well. So a watercolor that he makes in 1914 might be the basis for a painting he makes in 1923, and I think that's fascinating.
Before you set out to curate this exhibition, what had your interactions been with Chagall academically or even in the museum world? And how did your view of him change as you proceeded with putting this exhibition together?
Well, it's interesting. I'm drawn to the artists who are a little forbidden. And in terms of mainstream modernism, Chagall is considered a very sweet, sentimental artist, maybe not on the level of, say, a Malevich. He's kind of bracketed out. And I think his popularity has sort of been the death of him. He's sort of associated with other figures that I've enjoyed looking at, like Salvador Dali, people who did reach this wider audience. And so part of me is attracted to the phenomenon of that, because I'm a great believer that you don't reach a wide audience without having some great talent. And in the case of Chagall, what the show does is it reveals really where he was coming from and what world he belonged to. And it was a fascinating moment in the visual arts where you do have the legacy of cubism, and that's really what the first gallery is about. That gives him the tools to be a modern artist. But from there, he's able to infuse it with those folk traditions. And that's why he can speak to a wide audience, because he's tapping into a kind of universal aesthetic, which is, you know, he believes that the background that he had, the upbringing he had, the Jewish beliefs and customs and rituals make him unique. That's his story, and he wants to tell it to the world. And he does so very effectively.
Michael Taylor, curator of modern art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Paris Through the Window, Marc Chagall and His Circle, runs through July 10th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
In May, the Philadelphia Orchestra performed a series of concerts featuring The Damnation of Faust by Hector Berlioz. It featured an artist who had long been promised in Philadelphia, but only then made her official debut, mezzo-soprano Susan Graham. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met with Graham ahead of the concerts to ask what had taken her so long to get to Philadelphia. He discovered that, in fact, she's been here a lot.
Susan Graham, the all-American diva, who was born in the part of New Mexico that had all the UFO sightings, has proved that you don't have to be French to sing that repertoire like a native, and is so hardy that when it comes time to go to work at the opera house, she often prefers rollerblades to limousines. That's cause for concern, especially for those of us who want her to arrive on stage in one piece. And wouldn't you know, rollerblading is a habit she acquired in a place where lots of questionable practices begin, Philadelphia.
I did sing with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I sang Mozart C minor mass. I stepped in for Catherine Marshall a million years ago. But I do remember that I had just gotten rollerblades and I learned to skate going around Rittenhouse Square. And then I went on to become quite an avid rollerblader after that. I only fell down once, and I still have a scar to prove it.
That Mozart mass was in 1991, and just because she hadn't sung here publicly since then doesn't mean she hadn't worked with all sorts of Philadelphia conductors. She visited the Academy of Music to audition for Riccardo Muti back when she still had to audition. She signed on for one of Christoph Eschenbach's farewell concerts, but illness intervened. The orchestra's current chief conductor, Charles Dutoit, discovered her in the early 90s and immediately had her record an early version of The Damnation of Faust with his Montreal Symphony Orchestra. More recently, she sang the same work with the Lyric Opera of Chicago with a chorus prepared by Donald Nally, founder and director of the Crossing Choir in Philadelphia.
She's oodles of fun. She's such a great musician, and she has such command of her own artistry that she's a very confident, secure person. So you can easily make art with her because she will try anything. At our production, she had to sing her great aria, you know, in the third act from this balcony that was on a platform, and she was dressed like in a sort of 1970s dress, and I think she might have been smoking off the edge of the balcony. I'm not sure, you know. So she was great. She made it work in a terrific way.
Graham was smoking a fake cigarette, which is one boundary that she draws with high-concept stage directors.
Physical threat to life and limb is a good jumping-off point. In fact, in that production of Damnation of Faust, there were some times when it was really scary because I was up on a second story of this cutaway dollhouse kind of set, and walking towards the front of the set, there was no rail, and it was 12 feet down. You know, you get pretty close to it, it's kind of like, ugh. You find ways around that. Glow tape on the floor or something that you can feel with your foot. Because I was barefoot in most of those scenes. So, you know, I asked them, I think, to do something about the texture of the floor as I neared the, you know, it was like Braille. Braille for the feet.
But she sometimes puts her foot down figuratively and emphatically.
I have far, far, far too much respect for these pieces, for the composers, for the characters, and for the work. When you get older and you've been doing it for 20 years already, you kind of go, that's ridiculous. It has nothing to do with the story, and I can't make that work for me. I don't usually do it in those words, but at some point, sometimes that phrase does flash through my brain. If it truly detracts from the music or makes fun of the opera or demeans a character who has no reason to be demeaned or diminished, I have to put my foot down.
Susan Graham is now in the middle years of her career, and it's a curious place to be. Despite the lack of activity in the classical recording world, she's maintained an unusually solid presence on independent boutique labels and on the Metropolitan Opera simulcasts, most recently in Iphigenia en Tauride. That's one of the few cases where she's able to sing the title role of an opera, such as the lot of mezzo-sopranos. She's also under pressure to maintain her audience by singing different kinds of music, but at the same time is typecast in French repertoire. Even within that specialty, the raw sexiness of Carmen is not something she wants to take on in her early 50s. Mélisande, in Debussy's Pallias and Mélisande, has the opposite problem for her, too passive. So in the coming months, she'll be dipping back into the 17th century with Monteverdi's Coronation of Poppea. And her latest recording departs from her French specialty with Mahler's Germanic Rückert songs.
Last summer, I did my first Das Lied von der Erde. And, you know, over the years, the middle of my voice has taken on a little bit more weight. That's not to say that the orchestra won't overpower me at some points, because it just will. But I'm not too worried.
Also, she can get just as excited about a Christmas concert with the Montreal Symphony, with its ultra-serious music director, Kent Nagano.
It was, you know, in the cathedral. And, you know, it was a big, full-blown television thing aired live. It was so much fun. I have to say, Kent Nagano and Christmas music are sort of mutually exclusive, but we tried to make it as schmaltzy as he would let us. He doesn't do schmaltz. He's like, oh, come all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. He's like, get it over with.
On the personal front, Graham has had plenty of men in her life, many of them played by herself, since her best roles are males sung by mezzo-sopranos.
It's true that you've seen me in collars and pants, in those operas by Mozart and Strauss. And I guess it's my fate, because the music's so great. And I so often bring down the house. But one can get tired of those damnable pants.
Someone less illusory came into her life thanks to periodic itineraries that Graham sends out to friends old and new, listing where she'll be and when. That yielded a fortuitous meeting with her college-era sweetheart from her days at Texas Tech, Clay Brakely, now a Los Angeles-based technical director who had been through a recent divorce. They intersected in Chicago, went to a high-tone lyric opera ball, plus several after-parties. And in the 18 months since, they've been able to see each other roughly every 3 weeks.
He knew me when I didn't even know that this life existed. He knew me when I was only dreaming about this. And he certainly understands the passion and the drive and the commitment that, for the most part, that comes first. Our pact is, you know, he came up with this, is to protect the performance. So, and he's actually better at taking care of that sometimes than I am. You know, he'll say, no, we're not going to go out to that noisy restaurant tonight because you've got a performance tomorrow night. I go, oh yeah, right, good, thank you.
That's what every performer needs, a net. If one's entire life, personal and professional, hinges on the viability of those tiny little vocal cords, life can get very, very small, even though it's lived all over the world. Often, the more secure an artist is on the personal front, the more risks are possible professionally. Some of the roles that Beverly Sills was best known for were ones that she took on knowing her vocal life might be shorter, but that she had a family to come home to. Graham has never seemed particularly adverse to risk in the past, and now, well, consider the possibilities.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Phoenixville, Pennsylvania once flourished with industry but went into decline after its mills shut down and jobs disappeared around 30 years ago. In the past decade, it has been reinventing itself using arts, culture, and entertainment. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to this former mill town outside Philadelphia as it gets set to stage its 12th annual Blobfest, a quirky festival at the theater where this civic rebirth began.
This is downtown Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, about 25 miles northwest of Philadelphia. It dates back to the 1700s and was incorporated as a borough in 1849. Phoenixville was once the hub of iron and steel mills. Today, it's using the arts to help revitalize the community, starting with the Colonial Theater on Bridge Street. Phoenixville has been reborn more than once. The land sits at the juncture of the Schuylkill River and French Creek. In the early days, the waterways provided employment and resources. Its iron and steel mills would carry the town into the 20th century and even give it its modern name. Or, so the legend goes, says director of the Colonial Theater, Mary Foote.
the town was once named Manavan, and there's the story of the gentleman who owned the steel company, and he had his big house on the hill overlooking the company, and he saw the open hearth and the fire.
And he looked down and he saw the image of the phoenix coming out of the foundry.
Artist Lynn Miller, who paints, creates mosaic murals, makes giant puppets and stained glass, among other things, says the image of the mythological bird that was said to burn and rise from the ashes inspired him.
So he named the foundry the next day the Phoenix Works, and then the town changed its name to Phoenixville.
The town grew along with the local industry. In 1903, the Colonial Theater was built as a vaudeville house by Harry Brownback, in what Mary Foote says was an effort to give the town what New York and Philadelphia had.
And it was really a circuit between Philadelphia and Reading, where he would bring acts in who were on their way out west to Reading for shows.
When in the 1920s vaudeville died out and film became the rage, the Colonial transformed into a successful movie house. The location was used in a 1958 hit, which made the theater itself something of a movie star.
Before long, the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob. Starring Steve McQueen and a cast of exciting young people.
The mayor of Phoenixville for more than a dozen years, he's now serving a fourth term, is Leo Skoda. A longtime resident, he recalls a thriving downtown in the 1960s.
Three or four men's stores, women's shops, shoe store, jewelry stores, hardware, you could name it, sporting goods. There was everything. And Friday, Saturday were booming days in the downtown. And within about 10 years, we lost all that.
With the closing of the mills and a nearby military hospital, the town was no longer a source of many jobs. It became instead, says the mayor, a bedroom community.
We sit in an area where we're 6 miles from the Great Valley Corporate Center. We're 6 miles from King of Prussia Commercial Center. And the pharmaceuticals are just up the hill here in Montclair and Oaks.
But unlike the diffuse and sprawling suburbs, Phoenixville had over 200 years of community history, including a real downtown area that needed some cleanup.
The year I was elected, 1998, you could look up Bridge Street and see all these empty storefronts. You'd see drug dealers, prostitutes out in the street at night, drunks stumbling out of bars. That was one of the things that I worked on as mayor through two very good police chiefs. And it's not something you can solve overnight.
But Phoenixville also had an infrastructure packed with traditions and collective memories, including structures such as the majestic Colonial Theater in the center of town. The theater had managed through the 70s and 80s as a place for pipe organ concerts, but in 1997 it went up for sale. Mary Foote was one of those who couldn't stand to let the theater disappear.
When you think about how a town is going to redefine itself, you have to look at what are its assets. So a group of us got together and raised $500,000 and reopened the theater. We got it up to code and got it open and started showing movies again, and have over the years added other programming.
The theater became the new anchor for community development.
You really need a reason for people to come downtown. So the theater creates that reason, whether it's for film or for a concert or for anything else. Once they're here, they need to eat, or they may shop for Christmas, or just walk around and enjoy the atmosphere.
The theater restored seats to the balcony so it could accommodate concerts. Around 2003, an arts and entertainment strategy evolved as the mission of the Main Street Development Corporation, whose director at the time was Barry Cassidy.
We had a strong arts contingent living right here in Phoenixville, a lot of artists, nationally known muralists, arts educators, and we built upon them.
The art strategy gained momentum. Events started small, then seemed to grow exponentially through word of mouth. Art initiatives involving street performers, First Fridays, murals in the community, and then ideas that really wouldn't happen anywhere else, like the annual Winter Firebird Festival, in which a giant sculpture of a phoenix is newly designed, built, enjoyed for a few weeks, then burned to the ground. A wild idea that just ignited.
so to speak.
That got started at a meeting where we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do. I went to the borough council and I said, we decided that we want to burn a 20-foot bird every year. And everybody looked at us and shook their head and they smiled and said, great. And they voted that it was okay. And then when the bird started being built the first time, somebody said, that's a pretty big thing that you're going to be burning, you know.
Or the annual summertime Blobfest, a three-day festival with a reenactment of the scene from the Blob movie where people flee the Colonial Theater.
We have a live stage show, and then 450 people are packed into the theater, and they run out at the same time, screaming and yelling and having a good time. We close the street, and there's another 1,000 people across the street watching. So it's a big night in Phoenixville.
So how have art and culture and funky festivals changed the downtown of Phoenixville? The ripple effect is clear to artist Lynn Miller, who moved here over 15 years ago, and the Colonial Theater's Mary Foote, who remembers when, a dozen years ago, there were only a couple of restaurants.
Now there's about 13. Occupancy rate was around 30%. It's closer to 80% now. So most of it had their streetscapes improved, so it's just a wonderful difference.
When I first came here, I would ask myself, what am I doing here? But I started to notice a transformation in my life. And then I realized how this town was named from this very important story.
A story of an ancient bird who thrived, died, and rose again. Phoenixville is also rising, grounded by its historic structures, enriched by its art, and cultivated as a new magnet by a growing core of enthusiastic fans.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Phoenixville's 12th annual Blobfest takes place from Friday, July 8th through Sunday, the 10th. It includes a Saturday street fair, screenings of The Blob, and self-guided tours of local attractions. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.